And welcome to episode 21 of the Extraordinary Brains podcast. I am Max, and once again, I'm presenting solo, the second of our three partner episodes, so interviews with the partners of our previous guests. So this is going to be Nick Francis, the husband of Liz Francis, from episode, I can't remember, but if you look on our website, it'll come up very quickly, as in, you know, there's only 20 previous episodes. Now Liz has diagnosis of autism and was extremely interesting on her view on it, her view on the intersection between her own autism and the difficulties experienced as a mother. And so Nick is almost the sort of other side of that coin, in a way, and has a sort of external view on Liz's triumphs and difficulties. So it's a really lovely chat, relatively short. Both of them are very much to the point. Liz's episode still standing as the shortest episode, I think. And of course, I'm going to make that more likely if I waffle on any further. So without any further ado, it's Nick Francis.
Right. Hello. Good afternoon. So, Nick, thank you very much for joining us. And as we discussed before we started recording, we're really just going to talk to you as Liz's husband, because that's the you obviously have a you know, a very interesting life and a deep hinterland and a lot of interests, but you're here as a husband, and I think we've agreed that that's fine. But I suppose you're also a father as well. I think that's also going to become relevant, and I think we'll come to the boys as well. I suppose just to think back, though, if you think about meeting Liz and you know, how it all kind of began, what was the thing that you noticed about her? It doesn't have to be something different, but something you noticed about her when you met her.
And the relationship moved quite fast, I think one of the first things I noticed was sort of how much of an intense person, and I don't mean that necessarily in a negative way.
No.
Just that there was, I suppose, you know, now that, you know, we know what we know, and Liz has had her diagnosis, and, you know, hindsight is a wonderful thing, I suppose, almost a sort of a sense of hyper-focus on the relationship.
So specifically on your relationship, she was focused on that from the start?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it was a bunch of sort of, perfect circumstances as well. She was a student. I had a part-time morning job only. I think for like the first 3-4 months or something like that, you know, I think there wasn't a day that we didn't see each other. I think it was really quite intense from the sort of the get go. Yeah.
Okay. And so was she quite focused on, this is going to work, we're going to be together, we're going to have a family, that sort of thing from very early on in the relationship?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I think within 3 weeks, I think, of us being together, you know, marriage was already mentioned and talked about. And, you know, we got engaged after 3 months, much to...
Which I imagine that she thought was about 6 weeks too late.
Yeah, about somewhere, time, I think.
Somewhere there was a calendar that you were not sticking to.
Indeed.
Okay, so things moved fairly fast to start with.
They did.
And when did you become aware of her neurodiversity, and how did it make you feel when you first started to think about that?
I think I became aware of it probably, you know, about the same time as Liz. It was all when we were getting Daniel, our eldest, assessed.
Yeah.
And going through that process. And Liz has always been someone who who likes to do the research and find out a lot of information about, you know, things, and, you know, rightly being, you know, our child, you know, was doing all the reading, and then just kept asking me, going, Daniel's like that, but I'm like that. No, Daniel does this. I do this. Does this mean I have autism as well? You know, and so I think it was through discussion. It was like, yeah, you do that. Yes, you do act like that. Yes, that is, you know, who you are. That is how you behave. And I think initially, actually, there was a sense of relief, you know, being able to look back over our relationship and look at, you know, various flashpoints or trigger points or things that we knew Liz found difficult. And this, you know, gave us a lot of answers.
Without airing dirty laundry, but I mean, what are the things that you've noticed just in general terms? Because I think this is helpful for the partners of people who are neurodiverse rather than specific to you and Liz. But what are the sorts of things that you had noticed that Liz found difficult that made sense when you started thinking about her autism? Can you give me some examples?
Yeah, I mean, one of the big ones was going away. So anytime we went away anywhere, generally the first day and night, possibly even the first two, were always really fragile. And emotionally fraught, and particularly, you know, if we went away with friends as well, you know, there was generally a bit of conflict. But then, you know, understanding, you know, all of a sudden, you know, the desire for a pattern, for routine, for space, you know, for what Liz calls, I'm going to pronounce this wrong, I think, gestalt, you know, this sense of what is normal. You know, when you're not in your house, nothing is normal, nothing is right. So all of us, you know, we were able to look back and go, ah, that is why those never worked. And now we know, you know, so we know when it's going away, there are certain things that need to be done to enable a successful transition to a new normal. So that, I think that's one of the big ones that sort of clicked for us.
And it's interesting, this idea that you had of gestalt, the sort of, which I sort of understand to be just the feel of things, that the way things feel around you. And it's a little bit of a difficult concept to get your head around, isn't it? It's to sort of to grab a hold of. But is that sort of roughly what you come to understand by it?
Yeah. And so, you know, yeah, it's something that happens, you know, now when we go away, you know, one of the first things that happens, you know, if we're staying, you know, at my parents or, you know, going to a hotel or whatever, is, you know, the setting up of things that help the area feel normal and feel recognizable and have sort of tangible links.
Yeah. And is it specific items, is it, rather than there being a particular layout of things or...
I'd say specific items, but also just knowing where certain things are. So for instance, knowing where a quiet space is that Liz can escape to when needed, you know, knowing escape routes.
Just as basic as that.
Yeah. Knowing where facilities are, things like that, you know? Yeah.
So that's really interesting. So when you came to Daniel's diagnosis and Liz's diagnosis, Liz's diagnosis came somewhat after that. So how did that process feel for you? How did it sort of impact you emotionally?
It wasn't easy. I found it really different to how I did with Daniel. So for Daniel, I'd had a sense that something was different for a while. And so, you know, hearing sort of confirmation from the nursery and from the Ed Sykes and everyone else who was involved, it was it was almost a sense of relief.
Yeah. And
that explains it.
And presumably the potential for additional support.
Absolutely.
Comes more readily in children with the diagnosis than with adults.
Definitely. I mean, with Liz, the diagnosis process was more of a battle because obviously she is an adult.
Mm-hmm.
So finding the right the people and the services that would do that. But yeah, I think I found it more difficult because, you know, rightly, Liz then felt more permission and freedom to just be more who she is.
Yes.
You know, this is, you know, rather than masking or hiding or you know, whatever. And that did mean in some ways there was a change in how she acted in certain ways and it was, for Liz, it was a sense of freedom. I can finally be who I am.
Yeah.
For me, there was a bit of a sense of loss. It was something like, hang on, I thought this was who you are, but now you tell me that that's not, and now this is who you are.
Yeah, and she talked about, I seem to remember, either on the podcast or out off the podcast, I have to say, because I talked to Liz a few times, you know, about some things that she just wouldn't do socially anymore that she used to do, she used to put up with, but she's just... she wouldn't do it anymore. And I suppose to you, that could be interpreted as a limiting of social opportunities. I don't know if that's...
Yeah, definitely. There was that. It was this thing makes me feel horrible and uncomfortable. Why would I do this? Mm. Going to certain social situations where, you know, you sort of go because it's the right and the polite thing to do sometimes, not necessarily because you always want to.
To make up the numbers or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Liz is now far more free and willing to be able to go, but why? You know, just like both boys do as well, but why? And you go, because it's the right thing. You go, but why? You know, and obviously, you know, we're now, 10 years down the road since Liz's diagnosis, you know?
Yeah.
And so... I am far more at peace with that, and I'm, you know, far more happy and willing to encourage Liz to be who she wants to be. There are still times when it throws up curveballs for me, and I have to stop and think and go, okay, yeah, that's a societal norm or a construct, and that's not necessarily something you have to do. It's, you know, but yeah.
Yeah, I suppose, has it helped you... has it been interesting for you to sort of see the world in through that kind of autistic gaze in a way? Yeah. Has that allowed you to question things in ways that perhaps you wouldn't have been able to if you hadn't had an autistic wife? And
absolutely. Yes, definitely. You know, I think if I was someone who was just in a neurotypical family, you know, there's no way I'd have done the level of reading or research or whatever. You know, yes, I've definitely got more awareness. You know, I remember, was it Christmas? Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse was on TV, and Liz and Daniel watched it. I was at work, so I didn't get to watch it. They watched it, and I watched it later on the evening. I was talking to Liz. I don't know whether you've seen it.
Oh, lots of times. It's I think it's a phenomenal film.
But I said to Liz, that must have been an absolute sensory nightmare for you watching it, you know, because it's so colourful and there's so much going on in the film and there's, you know, all these different animation styles going on and constant movement and motion. And yeah, I think, you know, 10 years ago, I wouldn't have been aware of that at all. She found it a challenge.
Yeah.
she will never watch it again. You know, I think it helped that she watched it at home. I think, you know, big screen would have been far too much.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, and it,
actually, that's a really interesting one because that's a very specific. Sorry.
No.
It's almost deliberately disorientating, the animation style of that, and it brings you in and out of focus in a way that can be is almost deliberately confusing.
Yeah,
in the way that it manages focus and depth of field in animation. Really interesting. Really fascinating kind of technical achievement, but
absolutely,
but not an easy watch when you first start, even as a neurotypical person.
No.
But one of my favourite films of all time. So, still
good.
So there are still. I mean, I suppose that's sort of really kind of the meat of what I wanted to ask about is the sort of ongoing challenges of being actually probably, you know, a neurotypical person in a neurodiverse household. What is that like? How does that? Do you ever feel left out? Do you ever feel that your needs are not kind of front, you know, central enough?
Yes. In short, yes. There are times, you know, when I, you know, I do have to sit down with Liz and go, you know, hello, I'm here as well. But yeah, it's not easy at all. And I say this sensitively because I'm aware I am not the one member of my family with autism, you know, who faces challenges in a world that is not designed for people with autism.
Yeah.
On the whole. So, you know, I say it all sort of sensitively, but yeah, there are, you know, each one of, you know, both Liz and the boys have their individual challenges with it. Obviously autism, you know, presents itself differently within each person. So they all have their own unique things that they need to help them in life. And happily enough, none of them are the same.
Right, yes.
So, you know, for instance, you know, if we go out on a day trip, you know, I know what each of their individual needs are. It's just they're all different, and so then it becomes a juggling act of trying to work through that and support them. And you know, every morning routine, you know, they all want,
you know, they're lining up the puzzle pieces.
It is. It's lining up all the dominoes, and then if one of them goes at the wrong time, then it all goes wrong. And so, you know, some days, yeah, for me, it is a day of, right, okay, let's just keep all the dominoes in the right place, and then let's get everyone into bed, and then, you know, let's open a beer or, you know, let's head into the workshop and do some lathing and just get some headspace. I think one of the challenges as well that I found is so many of, I mean, the majority of the resources, and rightly so, because statistically, you know, are for, you know, neurodivergent males with neurotypical wives or partners, females. You know, yes. It's not often the relationship is this way around. And so, you know, trying to find necessarily, you know, people to relate to or resources that could be helpful hasn't always been easy. You know, there are some that you can flip and you can make them work. But you know, the resources are there because the statistics, you know.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the way around the majority way round. What's really interesting is what we don't have in this series of interviews, the female partner of a autistic man, which is interesting. We just don't happen to have had it. But it is very, yeah, I mean, that is obviously a really, really common scenario that I come across a lot in kind of clinical practice. So it's interesting because in a way you've mixed in throughout the kind of examples and the thoughts that you've given, you've mixed in unfailingly the light and shade of it. Do you feel like having the experience of neurodiversity in your life has really given you kind of gifts or sort of blessings, I suppose, would be one way of putting it?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it is very easy to look at all the
negatives. How would you describe those?
How would I describe them? I mean, you know, as we talked, there is definitely an increased awareness, you know. So even when I'm not with my family, if I'm out and about, you know, or, you know, at work, it's given me more ability and more skills to be able to relate to people in different ways, yeah. and to be able to open up other people's eyes to, you know, the breadth of autism and what it can look like and how to communicate and how to relate and you know, even in, you know, things that I do, you know, the website that I help design and, you know, there's various things that I design within my role in IT at work as well. You know, it's part of, you know, it's become part of my thinking, you know,
thinking about,
you know, how would this be
about neurodivergent?
Yeah, with sensory issues, is this accessible enough? You know, so yeah, I think, and yeah, I think it gives me a level of empathy as well. And I'm not saying I wasn't empathetic before I met Liz.
No. But... clearly, a very empathic guy. But I know what you're saying. It gives you a specific empathy for these particular challenges.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, there's been, you know, a few parents at work that I've been speaking to with their kids who have been having struggles. And, you know, obviously I've couched everything in the, you know, in the I'm not a doctor, I'm not a clinician, et cetera, but, you know, here's maybe some resources that you might find really helpful. And I get it. And, you know, if you want to come and share some frustrations, you know, then, you know.
Yeah, Bell, feel free.
So yeah, that, you know, there definitely have been blessings. Absolutely, it's not all hard work. It is a joy, and in fact,
it is a joy.
It is a joy, and sometimes, you know, I'm slightly jealous of Liz and her ability to see and say things in black and white. You know,
yeah.
No, I don't want to go to that. That's me, you know. Yes, I'm tired, I'm going to bed, good night, people in my house, or, you know, you know, just that, yeah.
Simplicity isn't quite the word, is it? Because that makes you, if you describe someone as simple, that's almost insulting. It's a purity, mm-hmm. in a sense.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. That I see in both Liz and the boys in the way that they deal with situations sometimes that make me think, do you know what, I would have never dealt with it like that, and that wouldn't have occurred to me.
Mm.
And it's
a different perspective that you can, yes. all, yeah, like any perspective you can, one can.
I'm too
from.
British to not be able to deal with it like that.
Well, being a Brit, yes, being British is in some ways a bit of a disability of its own. Do you? I suppose just looking back and forward now, just to kind of bring towards the close. Do you wish that anything had been different? Do you wish you had known of the diversity within your family earlier? Do you wish that there had been different process, or are you kind of at peace with how it's all played out?
I think the only one that I wish would identify slightly earlier is Thomas, our youngest. You know, when you know, he was a baby and a little toddler, and, you know, our family would say to us, oh, you know, oh, do you think he's got autism as well? Do you think he needs a diagnosis as well? And I'd look at him playing and I'd look at how he'd play and I'd compare that to Daniel. I'd be like, no, he's absolutely fine. You know, he's a social, gregarious, outgoing, happy child. And you know, through the sort of the mental toll of the pandemic in the last few years, it's actually become more and more obvious and apparent that actually he really does battle and struggle with both autism and also, you know, we're looking at ADHD for him as well. And, you know, I wish we had picked up on that slightly earlier for him, for his mental health, but also, you know, for the processes that you have to go through to get the support needed.
Yeah, which are a nightmare, of course.
Yes. In terms of Liz, I mean, in terms of Daniel, you know, it was picked up when he was around three. So I, you know,
pretty early anyway, isn't it?
Pretty early. In terms of Liz, I think I wish more for her, actually, you know, listening to her stories of school and childhood and the interactions. It's so clear looking back what was going on, but the damage that was done to, you know, her mental health and her confidence and her self-esteem through those, you know, harmful interactions is really obvious. And so,
and maybe more obvious to you than to her, actually, because I think I remember, if I remember rightly, she was rather kind of, oh, it was always going to happen the way it did, which is really common reaction with the neurodiverse people we interview. But I think from an external perspective, it can become more obvious that, yes, there really was things done and said that were harmful here. And
absolutely.
Shouldn't underestimate them.
No.
And how about the future? Do you have particular hopes for the future, for your family, for Liz, for autistic people in general? What do you think about that at all, and how you want things to go?
I mean, in the immediate future, the hope for Thomas is for diagnosis processes, etc., to be as
assessment
painless as possible.
I can only apologise on behalf of everyone involved in the NHS.
Please do not apologise. It is not your fault. There has been a small pandemic going on.
I'm not sure as much. That's. I think that's wearing thin as an excuse, but there you go.
Okay, fair enough. I mean, I think I see acceptance growing in the world around me. I still think there needs to be more awareness and understanding of autism and what it means and what it looks like. You know, I don't think I haven't heard people, you know, throw out the old Rain Man phrase.
No, fortunately, I think,
but there is still a certain sort of, oh, you've got autism, that means X, Y, Z. You know, which I suppose, again, you can't blame someone if they're in a neurotypical environment. Why would they know?
And also, it is very difficult for people to get their heads around the fact that if you know somebody has autism, you actually don't know anything about them. Do you see what I mean? Knowing that doesn't actually tell you a single thing about their abilities or their... what they like, you know, what they like and how they were going to behave, because I think that's true. I mean, I think it will tell you what some likelihoods as to how they might behave and how they might react.
Absolutely.
It's not going to tell you concretely anything about them, and that makes it very hard for even for clinicians to get their head around, because when that case, well, why would, what's the point of it? The point of it is that it's a particular cast of mind and a way of processing the world that makes you more likely to react in certain ways, but that's not the same.
No, not at all. Not at all. So there is that. And I think as well, you know, walking through daily life with the kids and with Liz, you do constantly just come across these moments where you're like, you know what, this is utterly un-autism friendly. And I think, you know, certain areas of life are starting to learn. You know, there are cinemas who are doing autism friendly screenings. You know, there are shops that are doing, you know, like autism friendly hour. But then Liz says, you know, why do autism friendly hour? Why not just be autism friendly? Just because you're autism friendly doesn't mean you're neurotypically
unfriendly.
Unfriendly, exactly. You know, I would have no issue going into a shop where there was no music and slightly lower lighting, you know. It wouldn't stop me going into that shop, but it would stop Liz going into a shop with really harsh lights and horrible music.
That's a really interesting point, because I think, but there's a financial and economic reason why music and bright lights is the norm within shops.
Yes,
I mean, persuading shops to go neurotypical, you know, neurodiverse friendly on a permanent basis will hurt their bottom line, really, essentially, which is hard to, but I think probably particularly in the current retail environment, it's very, very difficult to persuade shops to do. Albeit that actually may not hurt their bottom line as much as they might think it does. I'm not an expert on the figures, but I think that's the idea, is that the reason they're set up, retail works in a certain way.
Absolutely.
For sound psychological reasons.
Yeah, it's because it makes them more money. Yes. Mm. Yes. But yeah, it's not just shops, is it? It's other areas of life as well, that just aren't set up to make life easy for neurodivergent people.
So I suppose we could hope that some of that stuff gets better over time, and I think it probably will. It's a slow process, slow process.
It is. It's, you know, it's one of the reasons why, you know, we moved to doing online food shopping when Daniel was first born, but it's one of the reasons we've kept doing it. Because every time we took Daniel into a supermarket, it would cause a reaction.
Yeah, they're highly unsuitable places for anyone who's got any kind of neurodiversity of any kind, because they're so stimulating from a sensory perspective, but also there's wide open spaces to run into for a child with ADHD.
It's brilliant, isn't it? Yeah.
And all of these things to look at and grab and
taste and chew.
They're a nightmare. Environment. It's always something. I always want to know how supermarkets go when I'm assessing somebody for their child. It's one of my four big flashpoints of the day. Is the supermarket. Okay, great. Well, I think that's been a really nice kind of trot through your experience. Was there anything that we've missed that you wanted to talk about that we haven't really kind of touched on?
I don't think so. I was really concerned coming into this that it was going to end up, you know, me just being grumpy about all things.
It's always a danger.
Neurodivergent.
I don't feel you come over as grumpy at all. But
I'm glad, because I'm not. It's just there are times when it is hard and there are times when it's less hard.
Yes, but I think that's come over very, very strongly. And
good.
And actually I hope somebody who is in your situation, or maybe in your situation, will listen to this and have a kind of tempered optimism about things. I think that's what I was hoping for from today. Yeah. And I really think we've achieved that. I think that's been
good.
I'm glad. Really, really good. We're really, really helpful. So, Nick Francis, thank you very, very much for joining us.
Thank you, Max.
If people want to contact you online and kind of reach out, is there a way of doing that? I
can't remember. Twitter would probably be the best.
Yeah. All right.
Yep.
Fab. But thank Brilliant. You very much, Nick, and no goodbye.
Yeah, cheers, Max. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
So I hope you enjoyed hearing from Nick. His Twitter handle, which I completely failed to rather awkwardly get, is @NickF_1. So that's @NickF_1. He's a thoroughly nice man. And I think probably a good episode to play to or show to people who are in a similar situation to him, or if you are a neurodivergent person to play to your partner or to share with your partner. So one more of these, and then a couple of things in the pipeline. Any suggestions, please get in touch with us at Extra Brains Pod to make any suggestions at all, or to suggest yourself or recommend someone else. But we do have, I have some exciting plans to do with people who are both neurodivergent but also active in helping people with neurodivergence, just that kind of doubling up. So that's something to look forward to. But in the meantime, I'm going to say goodbye. So see you in a week's time, because I can pretty confidently say that's when Natasha Hickling and her mum and her husband will be in your ears. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.